It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How do you get your news, and especially online? How do you keep up? If you're like a lot of people, that answer has changed over the years. For a long time, social media platforms, including Facebook and Twitter, now called X, played a huge role in linking people to news stories. But new data from the website analytics company SimilarWeb shows that top online news sites are seeing drastic decreases in web traffic coming from those social media platforms. In just the last 2.5 years, web traffic referrals from Facebook and Twitter dropped over 75%. That's just the latest shakeup for news outlets trying to attract and retain audiences and keep revenue coming in. Less web traffic has meant more layoffs and closures in the news industry as outlets try to adapt. It also leaves the news consumer to navigate where to get news and how to vet it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much have you used social media for news? Has that changed over the years? Do you have, when your online news sites that you go to or aggregator apps or sites that you use to keep up with the news? Let us know. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patrick Johnson is an assistant professor of journalism and director of student media at Marquette University. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
The numbers sound pretty stark. How big a deal is this decline in social media links to news sites?
Well, let's just say it's another one of those wonderful hiccups in journalism's evolution to the digital world. I think what we see is such a significant rise in mis and disinformation in social media spaces that it's forced people to really reckon with what does social media do for them and how exactly has social media created a news ecosystem that's worth trusting. And I think that's a really important question that news consumers need to be asking themselves. To what extent did Facebook content really give them the correct news? And to what extent has now X, after being musked, what is it now doing to promote pro-social media content? I mean, we've seen headlines being taken away in the most recent update of X. And so news organizations are really going to have to figure out what does this mean when for several years they've used social media as a main driver to their websites.
To what extent, when that peak period was there, when social media was a key source of links to news websites, were news outlets writing in some ways for social media to optimize their content so that they would show up on the Facebooks and Twitter and other platforms to get people there in the first place?
100%. And it is laughable. Like, I mean, we saw in the advent of the internet, which when I talk to students about that, they're like, wait, the internet didn't exist. You know, there was these substantial panics around how digital first models were going to impact advertising. Mm-hmm. Well, then we had social media, in which all of a sudden we had another panic of, okay, so how do we get people to our websites using this like miraculous software that is social? And what happened was we saw different ways in which journalism responded. We saw people writing SEO headlines. We saw clickbait style headlines and images and graphics. We started to see almost this interesting return to like yellow journalism kind of practices. And it's kind of gotten away from us. I would say social media has become such a beast, especially in the news industry, that we are definitely in a place where we have to say, what did we do? It's Frankensteinian, so to speak. We've got this monster that we as Frankenstein have created. And now we're trying to say, okay, now what do we do? Like, how do we take this back? Well, it's there. And now, unfortunately, journalism is facing the consequences of not investing in other models and ways. I think there are organizations that are doing this, that are helping to combat some of this reliance on social media. But unless we're willing to buy into some of these organizations who are really doing their due diligence to bring trust back in the news, we're really gonna have to like fight to figure out what is attraction to news sites look like now that social media is such a hellscape.
And at a fundamental level, I mean, over the years, we've seen a lot of smaller communities flat out lose their local newspapers if they had one in the first place. We've seen cutbacks at a lot of the big chains, even some of the biggest names in news. We see headlines about layoffs, the newest one, Washington Post, some voluntary buyouts on the way. At all levels, it seems like, Patrick, a lot of media outlets that people used to rely on are struggling. How bad are things?
How sad do you want me to go with this? You know, I'm a blissful optimist. And the reason I say that is we do also have problems that we need to address. And I think, for example, hedge funds are buying up our newspapers left and right, and they're buying up our television stations, and they're creating significant layoffs in the process. Social media also contributed to those layoffs because we didn't need as many people because, quote unquote, anybody could have been a journalist, which I don't believe or agree with. We also are dealing with the AI revolution, and we're seeing this in the writer's strike, and we are seeing this in the actor's strike. I think journalists also need to push back in their labor unions on the use of AI. We also are seeing news deserts, meaning all of these local publications that are going under because people don't have the money to pay for the journalism in their communities. And so, yeah, that's sad. That's horrible. I believe news is one of the foundational pieces to how we live and breathe in a functional democratic society. The optimist in me says we always find a way. And again, there are certain organizations like Trusting News, for example, and to be transparent, I do research work for them. So it's not that I'm not just using them for that purpose, where they're looking to get into newsrooms and they're looking to do training and development opportunities, especially down at the level of local press, to get people to come back to the news and to find ways for community members to find trust in the news, to subscribe again, to be able to get returning customers. The thing that we're seeing the most right now across the country is this pushback on what journalism stands for. And so it's not even just the economic, it's not even just trust. It's this heightened sense of political concern, in that conservative readers, for the most part around the country, are retreating from the news. We're finding that they don't appreciate certain elements of diversity in publications, and that journalism is seen as a liberal cause. On the flip side, we're seeing people from marginalized communities, like Black and Brown communities, the LGBTQ community, who are also pushing back on journalism for not telling their stories appropriately, and for creating a historical harm. And so because we have all of these things pushing back on us as an industry, it's going to push us into a corner. And sometimes the best way to find a solution is to move from the corner. Now, if I have the answer, I would have a lot of money. but I do think we can get there. I do think that there's ways in which we can work collectively, both as, I think, as academics and as news professionals, specifically in our classroom spaces. I think right now the answer is in one of our classrooms. And we have to tap that. We have to find that.
We're talking to Marquette University journalism professor Patrick Johnson about a decline in social media links to news outlets and what it means for news organizations and the ways we consume news. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Want to hear about the practicalities of when you are on a computer or your phone or your tablet or whatever. How do you seek out news? Do you click through on social media links of one sort or another? Do you open an Apple News or Google News app or website and find links to lots of outlets? Or do you go to the Metropolis Times or whatever news outlet you go to, maybe a non-fictional one, for example. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Patrick Johnson, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Director of Student Media at Marquette University. He's with us today to look at the impact that declining social media traffic is having on news outlets and the way we get our news. You can let us know how you get news online on your phone or other device at 800-642-1234. Is social media a source of links to news items for you? The younger generation, according to some stats, TikTok, a rising force in how you connect to news. Is that you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Slinger. Jim, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your news consumption habit, Jim?
My consumption habits are anything that has to do with Fox News or CNN or MSNBC. I generally just have a question and I'll go on to Google or DuckDuckGo and I'll look for headlines that I see that the answers may lie in. Like maybe Al Jazeera, that's pretty unbiased in my opinion. I found myself looking a lot now on Twitter. I find a wide variety, or X, I found a lot of wide variety of opinions and just comments. The comments are the most useful to me. I hate the opinions that usually come from a writer. The bias out there is terrible. Liberal bias is out of control and it's obvious. And I just don't go for it. I'll never click on a link. I'll never even give them a click, knowing, you know, what news organization is. I just won't do it. If it's a liberal bias, I'm not buying it.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Patrick is seeking out news from a variety of sources, but he's skeptical about some of the headlines he'll come across.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty common. I mean, I think one, that's a prime example of like how people can be news literate, being able to understand the difference between a news piece and an opinion piece. And I think in agreeance with Jim, there's a lot that's out there that isn't news, that is opinion. And we have to be able to help one another learn the difference between the two. I think it's also important to make sure that we are recognizing that a lot of these, the combinations of places like Google, DuckDuckGo, X, Facebook, et cetera, all have algorithms that are reading all of the other data that we have on our phones and our computers. And so the more we spend on certain sites that aren't even news sites, the more those things are being filtered through these algorithms, which are then spitting out this content to us. And so that also changes our news consumption habits, because those algorithms, especially through social media platforms, are giving people the news that they think, or that the algorithm thinks, they are more likely to believe. And I think that's also a part of what we need to be better at thinking about, that these algorithms are far more dangerous, I think, than sometimes we give them credit.
Jim, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Patrick, you said earlier you're optimistic that there can be models for news production. Let's talk first of all about what we might think about, maybe a mid-sized newspaper in a mid-sized city. It has a website too, of course. Do you see a model by which they can start to build that audience and do what we used to expect as a watchdog from that newspaper?
Yeah, I think when we talk about new models of journalism or where journalism can go, I think community engagement is one of the core tenets to that. One of the things that I think especially national journalism has kind of complicated for us is that because we've lost local papers, people only see perspectives from the national press, which oftentimes are complicated by people having the name, an analyst title versus a correspondent title versus an anchor title. And so when you look at a mid-sized newspaper, for example, like I'm down the street from the Journal Sentinel, The more we're able to get newspapers and the journalists back within our communities, generating these opportunities for trust building to exist, whether that means hosting town halls or the journalist one day a week sitting in a coffee shop and having essentially like office hours where community members can come sit and have conversations about what they want to see and read in their publication, but also what are they critical of? What, you know, if people are upset about liberal bias and opinion pieces, publications need to be more willing to hear that and to understand where that's coming from and what does that mean? And what does that mean for a subscriber? Are people not subscribing because of that? Well, research says, yeah, they're not. They're turning away from our publications. So to me, a new model has community engagement as the core, with transparency and care closely tied to them.
Let's go back to our callers. Kimani is with us in the Green Bay area. Kimani, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I think it's two-pronged, I guess. The first part of my comment is why I think there have been less links on social media. I think the first one that's kind of obvious is that for a while there were a series of bots that were doing the work. But the second cultural piece of that is after what we had experienced with the elections in 2016 and 2020, I think we lost a lot of friends on social media. So now the social media posts are more back about the family and just the positive things that are going on in our lives. And then the second part of the comment is where we get our news from. My wife and I, we use, if we want news, we will go to either France 24, BBC, and crazily, Al Jazeera. I'm actually surprised at how straightforward Al Jazeera was. But so those are my comments.
Hey, Kimani, before I let you go, though, like if you want to read the BBC, you just go to, you know, BBC.com or whatever. You don't search and maybe come across articles. You start with the news platform itself.
Well, I was just talking about where we get our video news from,
gotcha.
Like what we stream now. But as for what I read, I use an app called Flipboard. And in that app, it's got a really cool user interface where I put what, you know, my interests are, and it turns it into a magazine daily. And
gotcha.
So Kimani, that's where I read. So
thanks a lot for sharing that. Patrick, that brings up something that disappeared that I thought was kind of cool for a while. RSS feeds online where you could set up that subscription, basically, where you see stuff popping up on different websites.
Yeah, I think we are going to see a return of that a little bit in newer models. And I think where we're going to see that is actually through newsletters, which is like another variation of RSS feeds in some respects. Because to me, those newsletters allow for a different kind of personality to exist, but it also allows for more strategic engagement, meaning people are actually getting to directly sign up for something and get a glimpse of the news that they feel they can use, which hopefully then builds them towards wanting to subscribe. But places like Flipboard, apps like Flipboard are a really great example of that. Apple News does similarly, where you're able to curate in different ways. But yeah, I think RSS feeds, I remember many of them. But I think newsletters are that new wave that might actually be really good opportunities for social engagement.
Kimani, thanks for the call. Kimani also mentioned seeing Facebook return to more, you know, what people you know are doing, which I think I've noticed too. That's all I ever wanted from Facebook, Patrick. Like, how did it rise to become for a while there such a key factor in spreading news?
Well, which answer do you really want out of that one? So I actually am no longer a Facebook user, but I do think one of the things that did occur, and Kimani points out the elections as being a core tenet of this, I think it's more 2020 even than 2016. 2016 certainly had plenty of commentary associated, but I think what we saw was this really interesting tribalism and this almost permission to be able to post things that were more hyper-political and less fact-checked. And so what we thought oftentimes was news sometimes really wasn't. It masqueraded as such. And so we did see a lot of mis and disinformation spread through Facebook in particular, which Meta acknowledges and has acknowledged in several congressional hearings that they amplified a lot of that mis and disinformation, especially around the campaigns of 2016 and 2020, because it meant more user engagement, even if that engagement was detrimental. And it's true. I think it drastically impacted people's relationships with one another. And it did so in like real nasty ways. Mm-hmm. And I think people are ready to be like, wait, where's the sun again? Can we find something a little happier to attach to? A more uniqueness to one another, I think, is definitely something that we're striving to come back to.
Just a minute or so left, Patrick. I asked you about a model for commercial outlets to kind of rebuild in this new, maybe post-social media linking to news era. How about nonprofit alternatives? There are a bunch of different examples out there. Any of them that strike you as particularly promising?
The 19th. And I think nonprofits are in many respects a significant part of the future of our industry. In part because they're able to target niche audiences, and they're cultivating content around certain ideologies and certain ideas that are really important. The other one I think everyone should check out, and I hope more cities take on this model, is Resolve Philly, which is a organization in Philadelphia that is really looking to reframe community-centered news. And so if any listeners listening, I think places like Milwaukee, for example, need their own version of Resolve Philly.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, have a great day.
That's Patrick Johnson, assistant professor of journalism and director of student media at Marquette University. He's with us today to talk about the impact of declining social media traffic toward news outlets and how we get our news online and what the future might hold for journalism and people who read it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released data that shows that employment rose by 336,000 jobs in the last month, nearly doubling economists' expectations. But why? And what does that mean for the economy and for efforts to lower inflation? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you one of those jobs? Did you get one of those jobs just added to the workforce? Maybe an early retirement to come back into the workforce at some point? What questions do you have about the strength of the labor market, about inflation, and more? And here's a very specific question. Did you leave the workforce between the ages of 54 and 65-ish? Love to hear your story. You'll find out why. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Barr is Professor Emeritus and Chief Analyst at the Century School of Business and Economics at UW Stevens Point. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thank you very much. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with last month's numbers. Now, asterisk, these things can be revised upward or downward in the months to come. But that said, I think these are pretty good employment numbers, right?
That was a very strong month. It was unexpectedly high. It was the strongest growth in jobs since January of this year. There had been an expectation that the job market was still growing, but that it was cooling off. But instead, you had this rather substantial kick up in jobs and also a kick up in job openings. So we now have 156.8 million Americans employed. That's the highest total ever in the history of the United States. And that is up about 27 million from the COVID low back in April 2020. So, the job market really is sort of like been the kind of the shining point in this whole economic recovery.
I'm assuming there are a lot of different possible answers to this question, but do we know why the job market continues to look pretty good?
I think the number one reason is that consumer spending has just been really, really strong. If you go back to the third quarter of 2020, personal consumption spending, and this is accounts for 2/3 of GDP, this has continued to grow in every quarter despite the ramping up of interest rates by the Federal Reserve. If you look back ever since the Fed started kicking up interest rates at the beginning of last year, investment spending has been up and down both by businesses and in the residential construction market. But kind of the common factor since the third quarter of 2020 and the driving factor, it accounts for 2/3 of American economic growth, has been consumption spending.
One of the big questions has been, okay, the Federal Reserve has been bumping up and bumping up interest rates over months and months now, hoping to rein in inflation. The thought was, okay, at some point that's going to slow the economy down and job growth is going to slow down along with it. Why does that not seem to be happening?
Well, you have a couple of things going on. First, I think with the whole inflation thing, I do think it's important to realize that the bulk of the inflation that the United States had and the rest of the world, I mean, inflation was incredibly high around the world. It was over 10% in the euro area, 11% in the United Kingdom, almost 9% in Mexico, 8% in Canada and Australia. A lot of that was really kind of international factors related to the war in Ukraine, specifically energy prices because oil prices spiked, also food prices because commodity prices, particularly wheat, spiked. And then you had Russia being the number one supplier of agricultural fertilizers, so those prices spiked. So the whole ratcheting up of interest rates, I mean, it is supposed to kind of cut back overall demand. But you saw a huge drop of inflation around the world. Basically, inflation dropped by over half just when oil prices moderated to some extent, food prices moderated. So that really kind of drove down the inflation. Okay, so now you have this jacking up of interest rates by central banks around the world because, well, that's what they can do. And it has affected investment spending, so inflation has been coming down, but it still has not really affected consumer spending too much because of the strong labor market. And I think that's kind of a combination of there's this kind of pent up strength of the labor market that's been going on for a long time. Also, really not last year, but before last year, the financial markets were doing pretty good. So again, it's basically been consumer spending driving everything.
Talking to Kevin Barr from UW Stevens Point, economist there. We're looking at the latest monthly job numbers, substantially higher than expected in the U.S. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your theories as to why that might be, your questions for our guest. And we're about to talk about labor force participation. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you are over, say, 54, have you thought about or did you leave the job market maybe earlier than planned? If you are working age, but under 25, same question at the opposite end. Has it been easy for you to find a job? Have you entered the job market yet? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin, you know what's coming. I sent you a couple charts I wanted to ask about earlier today. I'm always fascinated. Yep. There's the big chart, labor force participation, how many working age people are actually working. And that's gone down a lot over time. But then I saw another chart, prime age, age 25 to 54, I think is the range. That's held really steady and been really high for a long time. So what's the story?
Okay, so overall, labor force participation has actually increased in the last year. If you go back to September of 2022, it was about 61.8%. Now it's up to 62.8%. So that increased labor force participation has helped the job growth, because the unemployment rate in the United States has actually gone up since earlier this year. It was down about 3.4, now we're 3.8. So, okay, how can you have job growth, but the unemployment rate still goes up? And the answer is, well, because you have more people looking for jobs. You bring up an interesting point, though. What's really kind of driven this increased labor force participation, if you look at the ages, the age group 25 to 54 has really driven this. You go back a year, that that age group participation rate was 82.6. Now it's at 83.5. If you look at workers age 55 and older, that's held pretty constant post-COVID at about 38%. Pre-COVID, it held pretty constant at around 40%. If you want to look at long-term trends, yeah, the age group 16 to 24 is where you really see the drop-off in labor force participation. That's really kind of been the big drop-off. It's come back a little bit as the job market's heated up, but still, if you look at comparisons kind of in a long-run perspective, if you will, if you go back to the 70s through the 90s, the age group 16 through 19, the labor force participation rate was over 50%. Now it's down to 36.5%. If you look at the age group 20 to 24, again, between 1980 and 2000, that labor force participation was about 70, it was greater than 75%. And now it's kind of holding between about 70 and 71%.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Potosi. Lisa, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I am wondering, with this increase in jobs recently, how much of that is attributed to the Biden infrastructure package that came through? And whether or not that directly relates to the increased consumer spending.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. Any connection between the infrastructure spending and the Inflation Reduction Act and all of the federal packages post-COVID, Kevin, and our willingness as consumers to keep spending money?
I think overall, the government stimulus programs that were put in place post-COVID just helps the overall economy and get people back to work. And then there's kind of like a snowball effect. If you're providing people with whatever stimulus checks or you have new programs being rolled out that pumps more money into the economy, that enhances overall spending, then that gets more people back to work in other industries. The recent job growth, and for the most part, the job growth this year has been fairly broad across various industries. Most recently, leisure and hospitality has been kind of leading the way, but the job growth overall has been pretty broad in various industries. But no doubt, the government stimulus programs and in whatever form that kickstarted the economy, got the ball rolling to create the overall economic recovery.
Got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, please explain to me slowly like I'm a young child. So I just got back from the grocery store and a box of Bran Flakes is $6. So not only do we get inflation, we also get mortgages at 7.5%, raising interest rates, funneled money directly up. Consumer price gouging is unfettered, Matt writes. They will charge what they can and COVID set the pricing. Now, Matt, Kevin, chose a product line that I pay very close attention to. I eat a lot of breakfast cereal. He is right. Prices like bumped up and they locked in. Is there some element of price gouging? Hey, Rob and Matt, they found out, are willing to pay extra for this box of cereal. We're not going to bring the price back down.
Well, in 2022, both corporate profits and corporate profit margins, and the profit margin would basically give you an indication if prices went up to a greater extent and the cost went up for the corporations. Those were at record levels. Now, not every company had record profits. Not every company had a record profit margin. But profit margins were at 70-year highs back in 2022. They've come down a little bit this year. But generally speaking, the price to the consumer went up more than the cost to the business for actually supplying or for producing the product. And that wasn't always directly related to, because, well, we have less product to sell, so we have to jack up the price of what we do have. But corporate profits and profit margins were at record levels last year, come down a little bit this year, but there's definitely some truth to that.
Thanks a lot for that email. We are talking to Kevin Barr, Professor Emeritus and Chief Analyst at the Century School of Business and Economics at UW-Stevens Point, breaking down new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that shows surprisingly strong job numbers for the last month. You can join in with your thoughts or questions about the economy, maybe your experiences or those of a family member on the job market or as an employer. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kevin Barr, Professor Emeritus, Chief Analyst at the Century School of Business and Economics at UW-Stevens Point, looking at strong job numbers from last month, wider stories about the economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Hi. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. What did you want to talk about, Mark?
My children are young adults, and they have been struggling to find jobs where they can just get a full-time job. Everybody only wants to hire part-time, maybe 2 or 3 days a week, and then they're trying to juggle 2 or 3 jobs on all these different schedules, and they can't go and just work 40 hours a week like I did when I first got my job in the 80s. So that's a huge problem, and I think it's deterring a lot of young people from trying to find work. And another issue I've been hearing from friends in HR is a lot of the automated screening tools are screening out applicants, so they're not even being reviewed to be hired, and they're losing a lot of applicants that might be good fits, but they're being screened out.
Mark, interesting. Good luck to your kids, your 20-something kids. Kevin, this idea that young people are having trouble finding anything but part-time work, is that something that's going to show up in our federal statistics?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the part-time jobs will be in there if you're actually looking and you're employed. But he brings up a good point. It's not going to show up as far as, hey, I was looking for full-time work. Or let's put it like this. If you're underemployed, that's not going to be reflected in the employment statistics. So if I don't have the job that I think I'm qualified for, but you're still employed, where you're still going to count as being employed. But I think Mark does raise some really good issues. You might be unemployed. You might not be able to get the job that provides you with the benefits that you want. And in addition to that, I think there are definitely some challenges where you have to navigate applying for jobs nowadays, because you can be sort of your resume now can be electronically tossed just as easy as in the old days when they could toss your paper form of your resume away. So it's a challenge. I mean, there might be some keywords that you don't have that they're looking for, and consequently, you really don't get considered for a job that you definitely could be qualified for.
Thanks a lot for that call. John joins us now in Appleton. John, hello.
Hey, I'm actually one of those over 55s who's left the workforce at 55 5 years ago. And ironically, it was, it was a voluntary retirement package, but it's kind of strange that things were not tight 5 years ago. Now it sounds like they're extremely tight. So I don't know if your guest has any thoughts about the fluctuations like that.
John, before you hang up, I want to ask, do you ever think about going back into the job market, part-time or full-time?
I certainly consider it, and I do some gig work, but I would not consider it employment in any way. Frankly, more volunteer and those types of activities.
John, thanks a lot for the call and for putting a voice to some of these big statistics we're talking about. Kevin, people retiring at 55. Now, there was concern, I think, that people in that age range, especially with COVID, saying, oh, wow, am I putting my health at risk? They might nudge, as John did back in 2018, they might bump out of the workforce a little bit earlier. Have we seen that?
I think that's definitely true. I think there was also, and I personally know people that bail out of the healthcare industry just because of the pressure that was going on, the pressure and then the stress that you were under kind of during the COVID time. And it's kind of like once you step away from the workforce, well, do you really want to go back? And the numbers would say kind of, that drop in the labor participation force rate, that has stayed relatively, it's not exactly fully constant, but it's pretty much been around 38% for the 55 and above. So there certainly has not been a flood back into the workforce by that age group. Again, it's 38% now, it was 40% before COVID. And so I think COVID had some pressures and some strains in certain industries that kind of had or really encouraged people to retire early, and they didn't want to come back afterward.
John, thanks for the call. Marcus is with us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good Good afternoon, Rob. So I guess I'm wondering, is there some sort of metric that they have looking at the quality of the job? Because having, a part-time or several jobs where you are, making hamburgers or something, and it is not the same as having a long-term career. And so I guess, how do they track that?
Marcus, thanks for the call. Kevin, go ahead.
As far as the metrics, you'd really have to kind of dig into almost the industry by industry statistics. The job growth has been pretty broad. That being said, it's been strongest in the leisure and hospitality area. I think different reasons for that, just because that area in particular got hammered so badly with COVID. But in terms of the quality of the job, again, you'd really kind of have to look at industry by industry to kind of gauge, say, if there's a particular industry that you want to be employed in, how's it going? How is it doing? But for the most part, like I said, the job gains have been pretty broad. But that being said, they still have been the strongest in your leisure and hospitality area.
Marcus, thanks for the call. And Kevin, I don't remember exactly, but the monthly report does look at wages, and it looks like those have gone up, I think, now slightly faster than inflation. So not like huge jumps in wages, but on par anyway.
Yeah, for earnings growth, it's actually 4.2% increase over the last 12 months. And the Atlanta Federal Reserve has actually a measure that I kind of like to take a look at, because they use a three-month moving average, so it kind of smooths out any sort of ups and downs that might be a little bit temporary. And they had wage growth of 5.3%. That's a three-month average, and in August, that's been going down since August 2022. There's a good part to that, in that the Federal Reserve really watches the labor market, and they don't want wages to. If wages were to continually accelerate at a greater pace, then you'd probably see future increases in interest rates. But wages have gone up greater than the rate of inflation anyway. Again, not for everybody, but this is your median wage increase. So real wages on balance have gone up in 2023 compared to 2022 when they didn't. So wages are up, but the rate of increase has been going down.
Go back to our callers now. Bruce is with us in Cumberland. Bruce, hello.
I'm curious as to how this plays out, because when gas prices go up, all prices of everything goes up, and that's clear for transport being more expensive. However, when the gas prices go back down, the prices of things do not fluctuate with gas prices, and those monies are not being or must not be applied to better benefits or better pay for people. Where does this money go, and how exactly is that crunching the job economy?
Thanks for the call, Bruce. Kevin.
Well, again, I'll kind of go back to what I said back in 2022. I mean, it was a tough year for a lot of consumers, because yes, inflation was peaked at 9% back in the summer last year, but corporate profits were at record levels, and again, those profit margins were at record levels. So he brings up a great point: prices go up a lot easier than what they come down, so you don't get the same sort of flexibility going up and coming down. Once the prices are up, you got to look back a long ways in the American economy before you see any price deflation. You can see decreases in inflation, but to actually have prices going down, that hasn't happened in a long, long time. So typically, it can impact corporate profitability.
Thanks for the call, Bruce. In just our last half a minute, Kevin, the worry, of course, is, hey, are we headed for a recession anytime soon? Quick take on what to watch for to see if that's happening.
Two things. I think for the most part, the expectation of a recession has certainly waned. The Federal Reserve does not expect a recession. According to this thing called a CME Fed Watch, there's an 88% chance that the Federal Reserve will not change interest rates. And I'll just throw out one more wild card: watch the Middle East, and hopefully there's no expansion of a war over there, because that would always be a wild card on potentially energy prices and the economy.
Kevin, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
That's Kevin Barr, Professor Emeritus and Chief Analyst at the Century School of Business and Economics at UW-Stevens Point. He helped us break down the unexpectedly strong job numbers that came out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics last week, what it all means for the economy in the near future. Heads, you win. Tails, you lose. When you need a random result to choose between two options, nothing beats a coin toss, right? There are two options, heads or tails. 50-50 chances, right? Well, not exactly. Researchers at the University of Amsterdam put it to the test with results published in a preprint journal. No peer review on this yet. They report that they had volunteers do over 350,000 coin flips using coins from 46 different currencies, took video of the results, tabulated them. They found that one side of the coin came up 51% of the time, the other side 49%. Which side was slightly more likely? If you guessed heads, you're wrong. If you guessed tails, also wrong. No, it's the side that's facing up when the coin is flipped. It comes up slightly more often than the downside. Now, please don't use this for evil to scam people in a series of thousands of coin flips because A, it's unethical. B, it's a really boring game to play for a long time. Heads up, this is Central Time.